Hello, everyone. Welcome to Mystifyingly Missing, True Crime, and Thought-Provoking Events. My name is Rhonda Jefferson, and I'll be your host as we explore a very confusing and convoluted case today. Today, we'll be looking at the murder of Connie Franklin. Now, just for clarity, Connie was a male, and this takes place around 90 years ago. And by today's standards, we would have been able to figure out at least some aspects of the case very early on, and we may not have even gotten to the point of trial. And when I say this case is convoluted, I'm talking that even the alleged murder victim, Connie Franklin himself, testified in person at the murder trial. Allegedly. There's going to be a lot of allegedlies in this episode. Before I go on, I just want to cover a couple of things. One is, I'm very sorry it's been a few months since I've made an episode. As I've mentioned before, I do have some health issues, and I do have another podcast as well that I was trying to keep up with, and just hearing about this case made me want to jump back in to doing all of the podcasts again, because there are so many stories and cases that I do want to cover that hopefully one day I'll be able to get ahead of things. So if I ever have an episode like I've had recently, I'll be able to get, more episodes out on a regular basis. Also, anytime I do an episode, there's a very good chance that there may be some aspects of it that some may find triggering or they may find upsetting. And this case is definitely one of those. Like I said, it's usually in most cases or episodes that I have where we'll be covering some traumatic events. But like I said, this case, there are some, really big facts or alleged facts that can be very, very disturbing. I will leave the links to all of my resources in the description of the episode. And, what I touched upon a moment ago is I have heard of this case before, but I happened to come across it again and was listening to a podcast. And it just kind of brought back, memories of the first time I heard about it and wondering how in the heck could the trial have even gone on. This took place in 1929, and, of course, the technology, the forensics, everything that we use today was not even thought of, probably. Fingerprints pretty much would have been it, along with some medical evidence from doctors, but as you'll see in the episode as we get a little bit further on, those things even could have been brought into question. There was so little evidence. Today, I really don't see this going to trial. And it's very, very interesting to look at the way things were done at this time and why the prosecutor even decided to go forward with prosecuting the case of the alleged murder of Connie Franklin. Now, this has a couple of different names, but first time I've heard it, this was called the Arkansas Ghost Trial. Pretty much saying that, Connie Franklin was a ghost who testified in his own trial. When I first heard about the case ages ago, I thought, a ghost trial, did they do a seance or something and believe what was being said by the medium or something like that? But no, it was a live human being that testified about his alleged murder, if he was really who he said he was. So there's a lot of ifs and alleged, allegedlies. All of those will be used a lot during this case. So first, we have to kind of set the scene in 1929. And in January of that year, a man named Connie Franklin came into Stone County, and this was in Arkansas. And he was kind of a drifter, an itinerant farmer. You know, he didn't really have a steady job. So when he came in, you know, he really didn't make a lot of friends or hang out with that many people. But one person who, Mr. Franklin, who claimed to be 22 years old, one person that he happened to want to speak with and maybe have a relationship with was a young woman named Tiller Ruminer. And Tiller's name has been spelled a couple of different ways in different sources, either A-R or E-R. Now, something that would not really be accepted today was the fact that Tiller was 16 years old and Connie was 22, which later we'll even have to question that. So a 16-year-old and a 22-year-old, that would not be allowed, you know, at this point in time today. But even back then, there were some people who were a little upset about the age difference between Connie and young Tiller. Now, Connie also, he might be what we'd say was a ladies' man. And, you know, there were some people interested in him. He had kind of this disheveled or haggard look that it sounds like a lot of the women found attractive. Now, things actually moved pretty quickly. You know, again, Connie had moved into Stone County in 1929 in January. By March, he and Tiller had actually started to think about getting married. And that, though, changed one night in March. Tiller said that she had been violently assaulted while they were on their way to get their marriage license. They didn't have a vehicle, so they were walking along a road. And Tiller says that some men jumped out from their hiding places along the route, and they assaulted her while also beating up Connie. Because, of course, as anybody would do, if their loved one, their betrothed, was being assaulted in any way, he would want to try to protect her. However, there was more than one person out there that night. There were at least four that Tiller could identify. And what she said happened to Connie then led to this case. Now, the thing is, Tiller did not actually report it. This was in March, and it wasn't until a woman who lived in the area came across the hat that she recognized as being Connie's. This woman's name was Bertha Burns. She was walking through the woods one day and came across this hat, and it had blood on it. She recognized that it was actually Connie's hat and that he had not been seen. You know, he wasn't in the area any longer. So she became a little concerned. And she did confront Tiller with, you know, this is Connie's hat. But later on, she actually found a burn pile. And the burn pile had what looked to be bone fragments in it. So that convinced her to get to Tiller and have Tiller actually, you know, file a complaint, file a report that her betrothed had actually been viciously killed. It was in May that Tiller finally reported the incident to the police, when, of course, asked, "Why didn't you report this as soon as it happened?" She said that the men that attacked them threatened to kill and torture her family. They had said that they would whip some of the people in her family, her parents. They also said that they would kidnap her brother. So, of course, she wanted to protect them. However, now there were pieces of evidence that pointed to the fact that Connie Franklin may have been killed. Also, they were very different times back in 1929. And if the crime occurred as Tiller said, then that would be embarrassing to her, almost dishonoring her. So she wanted to try to protect that image, in my opinion. so that she wouldn't be looked down on by others in her society or in her community. Now, if the events took place as she said, which we'll get to in a little, you know, just a few minutes, then there's nothing that she should be ashamed about. However, the times were very different. So that could have also been a factor in why she didn't report it right away. So to get into more of the details of what occurred that night, we knew that she had been assaulted, but she was able to identify the men that had attacked her. And their names were Alex Fox, Joe White, Herman Greenway, Hubert Hester, and Bill Younger. And they were all charged with first-degree murder, and the trial was set to begin on December 17th. So what happened to Connie? Why was there a burn pile? According to Tiller, not only did they beat Connie, did they, you know, ferociously attack him, when they were done, they put him on, you know, a pile of wood to burn. So when Bertha Burns found those bone fragments in a burn pile, that kind of corroborated the story that Tiller had said. So this was evidence that led to these men being indicted, being charged with murder, and going to trial. The attorneys on the case also brought a unique dynamic to the courtroom. I don't know if anyone follows football. I don't as much as I used to, you know, before I had kids and everything. But in the last Super Bowl, it was brother against brother, one on each team, with the poor mother sitting there trying to root for both and not wanting either to lose and wanting both to win. In this case, we had for the prosecution, Hugh Williamson, and his brother Benny was the defense attorney. And while the Super Bowl is important to so many people, in this particular case, in a courtroom setting, they're not trying to get a trophy. They're not looking for accolades. They are literally fighting for these men's lives. The outcomes will determine what happens to these five young men. The repercussions of losing or winning would be dire if it went the wrong way and justice was not truly served. Now, to kind of set the scene of where we were and how the trial took place, that really has to take us back. The journalist, as this story started to make news, you know, it was sensational that they actually burned this young man, supposedly. So a lot of journalists did start to come to town, but it really wasn't a developed area. To that point, there was no electricity in the county. So, and we're talking the whole county, not just the city where this was taking place in St. James. The town itself really wasn't used to getting any visitors or tourists, yet all of a sudden they were inundated with press from all around, you know, the United States, wanting to cover this sensational trial. And they wanted to be able to get the information back to their editors and publishers very quickly. Because there was only one phone line in the whole town, the Associated Press actually put up another telegraph line for the use of the reporters. Now, bringing more misery to the stranded journalist, there was a winter storm that hit town at the time of the trial. And you might be wondering why or how they could have a trial with no electricity. You know, while trials, other court events happened in, you know, cases long before there was electricity. But in Stone County, they did have six light bulbs that they decided to use, that they could hook up to to a battery, not even, you know, like electricity. These six light bulbs were hooked up to a battery to try to provide some light. Now, while the details of the case, they're horrific, you may be wondering what that next thing is that made this case so much different than any other murder trial that may have been, you know, taking place at that time. And that's because Connie Franklin showed up to testify, or at least a man claiming to be Connie Franklin. After reading information about an upcoming trial that was about to take place about 2 weeks prior to the beginning of the trial, a young man actually saw the report, and there was kind of this word, you know, word of mouth kind of going about that indeed the murder victim was alive, and he had contacted the attorneys and law enforcement, and he was going to testify at the trial where he had allegedly been killed. So how could this happen? Well, the first thing I think we have to look at is the bone evidence, the fact that there was a burn pile. Now, if anybody is tracking my search history, you know, if there's anybody out there who actually tries to hack anything or get into my information, they'll be wondering why I've looked up how hot a cremation has to be and how long it takes to complete a cremation. If you recall, Bertha Burns found some bones. There was not, you know, any large piece of a skeleton. These were pieces of bones. To actually cremate a human being, it takes the temperature of between 1400 and 1600 degrees. And it takes about 4 to 6 hours. And at the end, a 200-pound person on average will have about 4 to 6 pounds of ash. And yes, there will be, you know, some bone fragments still left. However, we really have to question whether or not a burn pile or a bonfire could get that hot. Well, much to my surprise, when I looked up the temperature of a small bonfire and a large bonfire, it can get pretty darn close. A small campfire can actually get up to 1650 degrees, whereas a large bonfire can get up to 2000 degrees, and these are both in Fahrenheit. So that's a, you know, pretty high temperature. I would have to question it, though, because in order for there to just be some bones left of Connie, it would have to burn for, I'd say, at least 2 hours for there to be bone fragments themselves. That's just kind of a guess based on the information that I looked up, and without there being specifics as far as the size of the bones, how many bones altogether, because they actually misplaced a bone. So just kind of giving it the benefit of the doubt, it would have to have burned for 2 hours at least. And that's saying nobody would notice a large fire in the middle of the woods. I would have to question that in the fact that somebody, in my opinion, would have gone and checked on the fire if it was burning that hot and that high. It would have been very, very visible. And I would think people would be concerned about a fire that large spreading to other parts of the woods and furthermore into the community and into the town. So that really was my first big question, you know, behind or beyond the whole fact that the actual, you know, murder victim is supposed to testify. But in terms of the evidence, you know, we have to look at all those pieces of information and wonder if it was actually possible for a man to be burned at that high of a temperature for that long with nobody questioning it. So today we would most likely be able to test DNA, even to just find out if the bones that were found by Miss Burns were human or not. Upon reviewing the bones that were left, the doctor that would have been testifying to say that they were human bones, well, he wasn't really prepared to do that anymore because a shard of the skull had been lost. And he thought that it looked like a bone in the temple of the skull. But because he didn't have that bone itself at that time, when he testified, he didn't feel like he could say, yes, 100%, these were human bones. So I will have to give him that credit because, you know, it could have been,
a case where he said, you know what, they looked like human bones when I first saw them. And he testified to that. But since, there weren't the bones in front of him, he wouldn't be able to testify to that. So given this information, with the fact that the prosecutor now had this man coming into town and saying that, hey, I'm Connie Franklin and I'm not dead. And the doctor couldn't even testify to the fact that the bones that were found were human. Well, you would think that the prosecutor would maybe drop the charges at least. But no, they decided to go right on with the trial, that it would be up to the jury to determine who committed a murder, if there was any committed. And, in that case, you really would also be deciding if the man sitting there in the courtroom claiming to be Connie was actually Connie. But this is where it gets even weirder. The sheriff, of course, wanted to look into this man that kind of rode into town saying that, hey, I'm Connie Franklin. However, the sheriff, upon looking into some information from him, kind of tracking his movements, and I have to say, it was a great piece of detective work because, there weren't computers back then. They didn't have a centralized fingerprint database, but the sheriff was able to research and find out that Connie Franklin was actually a man named Marion Rogers. Now, while that still is in some slight dispute, it is accepted by many people that the man sitting in the courtroom was a man named Marion Rogers. And also many people believe he was Connie Franklin as well. Marion Rogers had been institutionalized in 1926. At the time, the hospital he was institutionalized in was known as the State Hospital for Nervous Diseases. But he didn't really like it there, so he escaped after being there about 3 months. Marion Rogers was also married, and he had children. So, even if he and Tiller had gotten married, it wouldn't be valid anyway. So on top of that, besides being the 22-year-old man that he claimed to be, it was found that he was actually 32. So this kind of threw a whole other wrench into the works. So first, was there a murder that was actually committed? Because, we really don't have a body. We don't have a, pristine or protected crime scene to say, yes, this is where it happened. It wasn't reported right away, so there could be no evidence collecting at the time, because by the time Tiller reported it, 2 months had passed. So first we have that. Then we have the fact that a man who's claiming to be Connie Franklin, he's sitting right there in the courtroom testifying that he is Connie Franklin. But then Connie Franklin is most likely a man named Marion Rogers. So this is probably the most confusing case I think anybody has ever seen. So to try to determine or establish the identity, at least the fact that the man sitting in the courtroom claiming to be Connie Franklin was actually Connie Franklin, they brought in people who may have known him at the time. Now, there were some people who unequivocally said, yes, this man is Connie Franklin. There were others, such as Tiller and her father, that said, no, that is not Connie Franklin. Now, this was kind of a small town, so one of the men who said that Connie Franklin was sitting there in the courtroom was actually Tiller's cousin, so that had to be kind of awkward, where this man, Coleman Foster, that was Tiller's cousin, was pretty much sitting there in the courtroom, saying that his cousin had lied about the whole thing because Connie Franklin was sitting right there, or whatever his name was. You did have to, though, put a lot of stock in what Tiller was saying, because supposedly she was the person who was the closest to Connie. But how close can two people really get in 2 months? And why, if he had to come in contact with some people and work with some people, while trying to earn a living, kind of wandering throughout the states. Why wasn't there a whole consensus of people who could say yes or no? So this was kind of going back and forth with people, you know, wondering truly, is this Connie Franklin and, you know, / Marion Rogers? One of the things that was given as a piece of evidence to claim or to support the idea that this was Connie Franklin was that the man who came in at the time of the trial and said he was the alleged murder victim could play the harmonica rather well, and so could Connie, which again kind of leads me to the thought that if people knew him well enough to know that he was really good at the harmonica, maybe even playing it after work in a bar or a pub or a restaurant, if they knew that about him, why couldn't there be a strong consensus one way or the other that this was Connie? We do have to think, though, about Tiller. If she were to take back her story, even if the man standing there was Franklin / Rogers, she couldn't say that, yes, that was my fiancé, because then she would have been charged most likely for filing a false police report or, you know, any similar laws that may have happened at that time. Now, getting back to some of the other evidence or lack of evidence in the case, one piece of evidence to identify the man claiming to be Connie Franklin was some of the medical records from the military for Marion Rogers. And that pretty much determined that the man claiming to be Connie Franklin was in fact Marion Rogers. Now, the judge pretty much had the perfect name for this case. His name was Judge Bone. So I did find that a little interesting. And even though it won't really have a direct bearing on the case, it was just kind of a coincidence there. On my other podcast, I actually did an episode where it took place in a neighborhood of Slaughter Beach on the Murderskill River. I'm like, who the heck named those towns? But this is a judge's name, so it was a name that, you know, of course he was born with. And one of the key pieces of evidence was bones, or lack thereof, because the supposed temple bone had gone missing. Now, there were also teeth that were in the burn pile, but those teeth were actually determined to be that of an animal. So the burn pile that Bertha Burns, which, again, the name just seems to be, you know, perfect for that. So the burn pile, things that were found in that area, some of them were determined to be animal. So given the fact that the doctor that was going to testify, you know, he really sounds like he had integrity, because he wouldn't testify to the fact that, yes, they were human bones, because that one bone was missing. So Connie Franklin / Marion Rogers did decide to actually take the trial or take the stand at the trial. So he did have a little bit of explaining to do about how Bertha Burns found a bloody hat that looked just like a hat that he used to own. He said that while he was heading out of town and he had a mule, he fell off of the mule and hit his head. However, he also said that he did not see Tiller at the time that she said that they were walking together. And I heard saw in some sources that they were going to get their marriage license. In others, they were going to the Justice of the Peace to get married. So maybe depending on the laws at that time, you might have been able to get both at the same time. You know, either way, Tiller had said they were together and were heading out of town, whereas Franklin / Rogers said no, he had not been with Tiller. The mule, you know, he fell off the mule and hit his head, and that's why there was blood on the hat. Also, according to Franklin, who I'll just call him Franklin from now on, he said that he and Tiller had actually had a disagreement. Connie Franklin wanted to get married right away, but Tiller said no, she wanted to wait. And he said that, you know, if you don't marry me immediately, I'm going to leave town. And when she said that she needed to think about it, he, in fact, left town. Now, this is a little confusing to me because if Tiller didn't want to marry him right away, why would she have been walking with him out of town? So this is a really big, red flag in Tiller's story, in that it's in direct conflict with what Franklin was saying. And we can expect that, too. Going back to the time period that they were in, is it a possibility that Tiller was afraid that if her betrothed, if her fiancé backed out, or if he left town, that she would be humiliated, somehow feeling dishonored? You know, again, it was a totally different time period. And you know, maybe she would have felt in some ways embarrassed and humiliated. And when the time came for questioning, she came up with an elaborate story. Or given the fact that the man sitting on the stand claiming to be Connie Franklin is known to be Marion Rogers, who had been institutionalized, could he be the one that was lying and, you know, making up these facts? One thing I did find interesting is the hat itself. I have to wonder if the newspapers at the time actually mentioned the hat so that he could come up with a story. I mean, what are the odds that Tiller would make up a story about him being attacked, which of course would mean some of the clothing he had, such as a hat, would get blood on it, and then Franklin actually in real life fall off his mule and hit his head and leave a bloodied, you know, hat at the scene. So that's a lot of a coincidence. That is one thing that is making me doubt Franklin's story, is it's just a lot of coincidence there. And what he's saying actually fits the narrative in what Bertha Burns found with the, you know, the hat with the blood on it. So I found that just, you know, something that stuck out to me. Now, just when you thought things couldn't get, you know, any weirder, what this man, Franklin, said was he'd heard that the men were being framed. Apparently, Connie was actually drinking buddies with some or all of the men on trial. So these were men also who could presumably say yes or no, this was Connie Franklin. At the same time, by identifying him as Connie Franklin, one could doubt their story because, you know, they're on trial for murder. They would probably say anybody was Connie Franklin. But, you know, he came forward because he didn't want his old drinking buddies getting tried for murder and possibly even, you know, given the death penalty or serving life in jail if he was truly alive. But he'd heard that this was kind of a frame job because of a feud about alcohol. Now, this was in the time of Prohibition. So these men and their families may have been involved in bootleg liquor. And, you know, there could be some territory squabbles. And all it really said was a liquor feud. And it, the sources that I read insinuated that this was being done to get some of the players in some of the main families kind of out of the picture. So that would be a very elaborate story and, you know, just a whole trial taking place because people were framed because of a liquor feud. So this would have been something, it sounds like Tiller's family would have had an interest in setting these guys up, so that, you know, the liquor feud would go more their way, the, you know, Tiller's family's way. So, you know, again, just a lot of rumors, innuendo, and nothing really concrete. There's nothing really definitive so far in this case at all, except for the fact that bones were found in a burn pile, but we still don't know what kind they were, and a hat was found. And from both stories, whether it's Tiller's or Connie's, they both have a reason why there was blood on the hat in that area of town, in the woods and around the road that they would have been traveling, walking out of town. It just seems a lot to go through if it was a, quote, frame job, to put a hat out in the woods with blood on it and then put some bones in a burn pile and hope that somebody finds it sometime, you know, that it doesn't sit there for 10 years with nobody paying attention, you know, just kind of walking by the hat and thinking somebody just dropped a hat. And, you know, not looking at the burn pile and seeing these small pieces of bone that were there. So with all of this going on, the trial actually only lasted about 2 days. I was a little surprised with that because it did sound like both sides may have called a number of people to try to, you know, determine whether or not Connie Franklin was still alive, if the man sitting in front of them was or was not Connie Franklin. 2 days seemed kind of quick to me. But given the fact that we don't even know if somebody was actually killed, you might think that, you know, the whole jury deliberation would be pretty quick and they would come out soon and say, you know, yes, we're acquitting. That's my opinion, at least. You know, they would find him not guilty or the men not guilty because, you know, we don't even know if a murder took place. But no, they actually did deliberate and they came out saying that they were deadlocked. You know, there's this little thing called reasonable doubt. And I really think having a man sitting in the courtroom that some people have testified is in fact the murder victim and more than one person, you would think that would be enough reasonable doubt, but no. They could not come to, you know, a verdict. And the judge, though, was not happy. When the jury advised him of this and, you know, the media was kind of swarming the town, he wanted that to be over. He said to the jury, you know, that they had already spent $8,000 on the trial, which, you know, $8,000 was a lot of money back then. So they were going to come up with a verdict, you know, like it or not. You know, that might not actually fly today. You know, a judge might, you know, tell them to go back and maybe deliberate a little bit longer. But this judge was pretty adamant that you're going to come up with a verdict. We're not going to go through this again. That would be more money and a lot of people swarming our town that we went out. So they did go back and deliberate and they came back with a not guilty verdict, which I think was the right verdict, just because there were so many questions in this case. One of the biggest, even though I know it was a different time, was why Tiller did wait so long. Yes, there may have been threats towards her family as well, but when we're talking about murder, that's one question, you know, we really have to think of seriously and why it took so long to come forward. Because if the men were arrested, then she should be safe. But then all the other red flags come up. You know, what happened to the temple bone that supposedly was, you know, a human bone? Why were there animal teeth in the burn pile? Why was it a third party that really forced Tiller to come forward? And it sounds like Bertha Burns really was the driving force when she confronted Tiller about, you know, hey, I found this hat. I know it's Connie's. What happened? And, you know, the biggest question of all is, did Connie really die? And was the man sitting there in the courtroom truly the man who claimed to be Connie Franklin? So again, with the military records, doctors were able to determine that this was in fact a man named Marion Rogers, but Marion Rogers could have been using an alias since he was, you know, trying to stay out of the you know, spotlight or trying to stay out of, you know, anyone finding out who he was because he wanted to stay out of the institution. I know I took a long way to get to that, but yeah, he wanted out of the institution. He didn't want to be in a hospital, so he'd escaped and he's not using his real name. So if we look at the verdict itself and it was not guilty, we then have to question whether there was a murder at all. the not guilty verdict is saying just, you know, the men that were on trial didn't commit the crime. It didn't really answer whether or not a crime took place. We can, you know, kind of infer from that that the jury thought that really a crime did not take place and that Connie Franklin was still alive. So we really have to question a lot of Tiller's motives. To me, it comes down to humiliation and embarrassment for a couple of different reasons. One was her, you know, beloved leaving her, and the other was if there had been any type of sexual contact or relationship at that time, you know, she would have been unfortunately looked down upon. And whether, you know, we look at this in a completely different way, and she should not have had a reason to be embarrassed or anything about that, you know, at that time, just the whole expectation of what young women were expected to be like and what they should do and not do, you know, it's completely different than it is today. Even though looking at the case and how old she was, and even if Connie was just 22 and not the 32 that Marion Rogers was, that's still an age gap. You know, 22 is an adult, 16 is still a juvenile, you know, not hitting the age of majority yet. So that was a big age difference given that she was only 16. When you factor in then that Marion Rogers was actually 32, you know, now he would actually be on trial for any relationship that he had with her because she was a minor and, you know, he was double her age. So when it comes down to it, you know, Connie, if the man, you know, sitting up there was in fact Connie and Connie had not been killed, then, you know, really, in my opinion, he was kind of preying on a young girl. So there's a lot going on in this case. And I think for Tiller, if there was a reason to come up with this story, it was to kind of protect her image. But in the long run, when this man shows up saying that he's Connie, it kind of did the reverse. And I'm sure that the town itself was split. There were those who thought, yes, this man is Connie. And for some reason, Tiller just kind of threw those men under the bus that she accused, even though I don't think that was a term back then, but you get the idea. Then you have the other side of the town that may be completely on Tiller's side and saying, no, that man was not Connie Franklin, and those young men who were tried got away with murder. You know, so it probably caused at least a small rift in the town, if not one that lasted for years to come. One side note kind of about, I guess you would say, the frame job, if in fact there was actually a frame in place to try to get these men convicted. Bertha Burns actually had testified against Alex Falk and Ross Younger in that year as well. She claimed that these young men had actually flogged her and her husband, and they had been convicted. So the idea that they might whip Tiller's parents, like she said they had told her, that's not completely out of the realm of possibility. The thing is, it was Bertha Burns who found the evidence. So could she have been trying to get retaliation? Or is the town just so small that, you know, people come across these things and there's coincidences like this all the time? But that was really something that would not have been brought up in the trial itself. But yes, Bertha Burns had a reason to dislike and, you know, even try to set up these two young men. Am I saying that she did it? No. I'm just saying if I'd been on the jury and, you know, it's a small town, small county, and I found out that she was the one who had actually found the bones, found the hat, and, you know, two of the young men that had been convicted of the flogging of her and her husband, they were two of the accused. To me, that would seem really, really coincidental, and I'd have a hard time really believing that that could happen. It would just be that reasonable doubt for me. Now, a lot of people in this small town, one of the reasons they didn't like the media coming in is even at that time, people who lived, you know, kind of in the rural areas, who lived in mountains or, you know, forested country, things like that, they were stereotyped. And that stereotype was, you know, being uneducated. And I don't want to use some of the terms that, you know, are used even today, because I do think they're derogatory, because it's kind of perpetuating a stereotype. And I don't like that. So I'm not going to use the terms. But basically that the media was portraying this county as just being very ignorant of many things. So the people of the town really wanted the press out of there. Some of the residents really felt like the press was kind of coming after their town, because there were other crimes that happened in larger cities that some of the residents of Arkansas, at least in that area, they would have thought, you know, the press should be focusing on some of these big crimes that are taking places in the big city. Why are they down here in our little town, you know, about this one trial, and they're depicting us as these uneducated men and women who, you know, make up these elaborate stories, or that they're, you know, very, very violent in the way that, you know, they go about killing people and the motives they have for killing the people. And when the idea of the bootleg liquor came out, you know, that kind of perpetuates the whole moonshine and moonshine running, things like that, which, again, people kind of stereotype. So I know that the town itself was very, very happy when the verdict was actually given and everybody from the press could get out of their town. As far as the man, Marion Rogers, well, unfortunately, in 1932, a man was found on the side of the road. It was December and it was very, very cold outside. And when he was found, you know, of course he was given medical attention, but he died after 3 days, you know, of being under doctor's care. Unfortunately, what had happened was he had had appendicitis and he may have just laid down because he couldn't go any further, you know, that he was so tired that he just had to lay down, or he may have just collapsed. And so he was laying on the side of the road for who knows how long. And between the appendicitis and the fact that he was exposed to the cold for so long, that's what led to his death. And that was Marion Rogers. Now, sometime about 40 years after this case took place, there was a man who lived in Mountain View, Arkansas. They said that he used to play his harmonica just like Connie Franklin. And later, that's what the man claimed, that's who the man claimed to be, was Connie Franklin. So we'll never really know exactly what happened. You have, you know, a victim who may not have even been the man of the same name. In other words, were there two men, a Connie Franklin and Marion Rogers? And if there were two men, it sounds like they determined that the man sitting in the courtroom was Marion Rogers. And if that's the case, then what happened to actually, you know, Connie Franklin? And why or how did they lose something so important as the temple bone? But if that was Connie Franklin, then that means Tiller lied. If that wasn't Connie Franklin, then was he actually killed? Because there's really no evidence to say he was, but at the same time, there's not an official record. So there are so many what's and ifs in this case that it can get kind of confusing, to say the least. But to share my thoughts on it, I think that Connie Franklin was not killed, that Marion Rogers sitting on the stand that day was in fact the man who had been Connie Franklin. As far as the man who 40 years later claimed to be Connie Franklin, well, maybe he was just trying to get some attention. I've heard of other people who were kind of infamous like John Wilkes Booth as an example. They say that he actually lived and there was a man who claimed to be him right before he died. So there's a whole number of people that, after many years, someone claims to be them. There's the Tsarina or Princess Anastasia. There was someone who claimed to be her living in America. Another woman who claimed to be Amelia Earhart. There's just been so many people who claim to be someone legendary or infamous, and they're actually someone else completely. They're not really that person. So, again, I'm kind of leaning to the fact that there was no murder. And I do think the man, Marion Rogers, was actually the man, Connie Franklin. There were too many people who said, yes, that was Connie, especially Tiller's cousin who said that. There's too many for me to say, no, that wasn't Connie. To me, all those people saying, yes, it was Connie means it was Connie. So those are just my opinions. So this was kind of an interesting case to get back into the swing of things. It's been a hectic few months. There have been some other losses in my family since that time. I had said previously in previous episodes about, my brother being killed in the car accident and all of that, the stress between that and other things that have happened. It causes my illness to flare up and then it's very difficult for me to do anything. But I love doing the research and finding out about history and things that have happened in the past. And this, I think, was kind of a good juxtaposition of what, not even 100 years ago, what was happening then in terms of forensics, as far as, what determines when a case can go to trial. I really think someone claiming to be the murder victim and you don't have a body, that should at least mean you shouldn't proceed with charges or proceed to trial, but that's just my opinion. But today we would run a DNA test against a toothbrush or something and be able to find out whether or not that was truly the person. Back then they didn't have that. And if they didn't have Connie Franklin's fingerprints on file, or they didn't know the name to look under, they couldn't really verify a lot of information, especially since Connie was in the area for such a short period of time. There really wasn't much for them to go on. But again, I think it was a good piece of detective work for the sheriff to be able to find out that, the man sitting in the courtroom was Marion Rogers. So I will be getting a new episode out about every 2 to 3 weeks. I don't want to ever give an exact time because I never know if, again, something may come up and I'm not able to do one or the other podcast episodes, but I do have a lot that are really research intensive. So my plan is to, do the less research intensive episodes, do them more frequently while I'm working on the longer ones. If you do want to check out Danger on Delmarva, the other podcast I have about true crime and tragedies, I'll leave a link in the description of this episode. And I do also have another podcast called See the Invisible, and that's not about like magic or anything. It's about living with a rare disease, a chronic and rare illness. And so, unfortunately, I haven't gotten an episode out in a while for that one either. But, I enjoy, like I said, research and finding out new information. So I'll leave those links in the description. I hope you all enjoyed seeing or hearing about a trial from less than 100 years ago where the alleged murder victim testified. All right, everybody have a great day or night whenever you're listening, and I will talk to you soon. Bye.